morning and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm Carol Van Damme in Washington, and here are some of the top stories making news across South Sudan and the rest of the region this Thursday, January 16th, 2025. A Lebanese-American analyst says the Middle East ceasefire deal is hanging by a thread.
Netanyahu has been facing pressure from his left as well as from his right. The left, many of the families of the hostages, as well as those who are opposed to his policies.
And commercial drivers are fed up with South Sudan's illegal checkpoints.
The money they are charging from us at the roadblocks is too much. In one checkpoint, you will find four tables, and each table will want 15,000 SSP. Other demands, 20,000 SSP. At least you must pay the money.
These stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says a vote on the peace deal between Hamas and Israel that was scheduled for today will be delayed. It is a setback to hopes that an end to the fighting would take place on Sunday. U.S. President Biden and Qatar's prime minister announced separately yesterday that Israel and Hamas reached a multi-phase ceasefire deal that commits them to end the war in Gaza. Edmund Garib is a Lebanese-American scholar at the Washington Institute for Peace and Development and a former distinguished scholar of global studies at American University here in Washington. I asked him whether the delay in Israel's vote means the deal could be in serious jeopardy.
There is really a question about that, because Netanyahu has been facing pressure from his left as well as from his right. The left, many of the families of the hostages, as well as those who are opposed to his policies in Gaza and in the area. And yet he's also facing threats from his right, two important ministers who he put in the government, Smotrich and Ben-Gvir, have warned that they might quit the government and that they considered the agreement would be a disaster. And they had been talking about the need to continue to cleanse Gaza, as they call it. So he's facing the problems from his right and his left. Also, now he's facing some pressure from both current president, President Biden, as well as coming president, President Trump, who want to see an agreement and think this agreement is in the interest of Israel.
With the timing of this, you know, it's just a few days now before President-elect Trump is sworn in. So is this a victory for President Biden, or can Trump rightfully claim some credit here for this ceasefire deal if it goes through?
I think if it goes through, and that's a very good point that you mentioned, because we still have to wait to see whether Prime Minister Netanyahu is going to stand up to the threats from his right, or he is going to continue to undermine. And as several of his opponents on the ground have said, that it's his policy, and he has been sabotaging the reaching of an agreement. But as to the point of who had a lot of influence, there's no doubt that a lot of the work has been done under President Biden and by some of President Biden's top government officials, whether it was Secretary Blinken or head of the CIA and Brett McGurk, who was the individual responsible for the Middle East at the National Security Council at the White House. But there's no doubt that I think President Trump has also had an impact. First, he had warned that hell might break loose if there is no agreement. He criticized Hamas mainly, but at the same time, he also wanted Prime Minister Netanyahu to move, and he sent one of his top aides who has been involved in this, and last Saturday, he met with Netanyahu and told him, apparently, that President Trump would like to see an agreement done. And I think the pressure, actually, perhaps there was more pressure from Trump at this time, because I think Netanyahu had been hoping that President Trump would be more sympathetic even than more supportive than President Biden.
What do you make of the attacks overnight? There was more bombings by Israel in Gaza. Over 70 Palestinians were killed. Is the ceasefire being taken seriously, the ceasefire talk?
Well, this is actually a very good question. Is Netanyahu right now, maybe before the agreement, is he trying to send a message to both to Hamas, but at the same time to his ministers and who are even more hardline than he is, that he's still tough, that he's taking a tough stand against Hamas. But in fact, again, more and more of the civilians in Gaza, the overwhelming majority of the people who have been killed have been civilians, children, women, people who have nothing to do even with Hamas. But I think part of it may have something to do with one of the critics, Israeli critics, has said that the spirit of vengeance is still involved as well, and that he's willing to say basically also that Netanyahu wants to send a message that if he doesn't reach the agreement that he wants, war could be started up again down the road.
That is Lebanese-American scholar Edmond Gharib at American University speaking to me earlier today. Doctors Without Borders, or MSF, said on Thursday it was suspending operations in two South Sudan counties after its staffers came under attack from an armed group. MSF said six staff were traveling on a river in Upper Nile State in the northeast of the country on Wednesday after delivering hospital supplies when they came under attack. Unidentified gunmen opened fire on the boats, forcing the MSF staff to jump into the river and swim to safety in a nearby village, said the NGO statement. One staff member was injured in the escape. Zakaria Mwatia, MSF's head of mission for the country, called the attacks like this one on healthcare workers unacceptable and said they highlight the volatile environment in which humanitarian organizations operate in South Sudan. People living in Nasser and Ulaan counties already face limited access to healthcare, and the impact of such violence further jeopardizes the delivery of essential medical services, said Mwatia. Some commercial drivers along the Yambio-Juba Highway say the Joint Security Forces continue to charge them fees at roadblocks and run illegal checkpoints, despite an order some weeks ago by President Salva Kiir to remove all those checkpoints along major roads. Matia Samuel Timotio reports for VOA from Yambio.
In December, President Salva Kiir directed the Interior, Defense and National Security Ministers to remove illegal checkpoints along the major highways from Juba leading to other states of South Sudan. Laruba Joshua, a driver in Yambio, he says the Western Equatorial State Government needs to follow the President's order and remove illegal checkpoints as Joint Security Forces continue to extort money from drivers.
The money they are charging from us at the roadblocks is too much. In one checkpoint, you will find four tables and each table will want 15,000 SSP. Other demands, 20,000 SSP. At least you must pay the money. A vehicle even can be stopped for just 500 SSP. We want the government to help us to remove the roadblocks so that we, the drivers, can help our citizens who want to travel to other states.
Another commercial driver who identified himself just as David, for fear of government reprisal, asks, why is it only Western Equatorial State that does not want to implement the president's order while other states remove their illegal checkpoints?
Is South Sudan divided into two? Why a Western Equatorial State is different? In Western Equatorial State, you find from one roadblocks to other. If there is order from the president, let it be executed because we are all South Sudan. We, the drivers, the issue of illegal checkpoints must be removed so that the poor innocent citizen who know nothing about dollar can survive. When a trader is taxed high on the roads, he pours the money on his goods to recover his money.
Chris Malish is the Western Equatorial State's Chamber of Commerce spokesperson.
The number of roadblocks that were there before, to be honest, it was really trying to interfere with the businessmen when they are bringing in their goods. Soldiers could collect a lot of money from them on the way and extort a lot of money from them. And this later on results to higher prices in the market, and which the citizens down here suffer the consequence, and yet of something that they don't know anything about.
Jamie Severino is the state minister of local government and law enforcement. He says the state instructed the head of the Joint Security Force to dismantle all the illegal checkpoints and roadblocks in the state. He says there were 34 checkpoints from property to Kubri Bor in the state, but only 10 will be maintained.
I'm following up with the commissioners. They are telling me most of the illegal checkpoints are being removed out. But again, some of our traders are complaining that there are still some checkpoints on the roads, and it's good that they are giving us information. They will try to cross-check again with the commissioners whether those checkpoints are still existing or not, because we just need the checkpoints at the border of each county or the state. There should be no any checkpoints or any other street.
Major General James Akech is Western Equatoria State's Army Division 6 commander in Maridi. He says the illegal checkpoints were removed except for one in Kubri Bor, where the IO forces are.
We sent Brigade 18 to move that area. Start from Maridi, you go to Palatina, you go to Barun, you go to Langwa, Karika, Yukatobi, Mundri, there's no checkpoint. And that report, yes, we need that report. Somebody is there, could be his own road block. After when we move it, we can be dealing with him.
Last year, Western Equatoria State Governor Alfred Futio directed the commissioners of Greater Mundri counties to remove illegal checkpoints. This was done after travelers raised concerns about dozens of roadblocks on the Juba-Mundri-Yambio Highway that some members of organized forces set up to extort money from drivers. The government last year paid 1 month's salary arrears to civil servants and organized forces after nearly going unpaid for 12 months. For VOA News, I am Matias Samuel Timatio, reporting from Western Equatoria State Capital, Yambio.
Despite efforts by authorities to combat gender-based violence, Botswana saw nearly 100 women raped and another 10 murdered during the late December festive season. The government has called for collaborative efforts to fight the scourge and amid public outrage. From Gaborone, Mkondisi Dube has this report.
Addressing the media Tuesday, Botswana Police Commissioner Diana Marate said 10 of the 25 murder cases recorded between December 29 and January 2 were related to gender-based violence. During the same period, Marate says 93 incidents of rape against women were reported. She says, of all the reported cases, which stand at 298 cases, 61% or 181 were related to gender-based violence. What comes out is clear that we are a nation with a culture of violence. The government introduced new laws and policies last year meant to combat gender-based violence, including dedicated courts to deal with such cases and the establishment of a sex offenders registry. Despite the measures, gender-based violence persists. Minister of Youth and Gender Affairs, Lisao Chombo, is calling for a collaborative approach.
And what we desperately need is a preventative approach to say, in the way that we behave with each other, in our personal spaces and professional spaces, we all take this as a priority to ensure that we inculcate a culture that is conducive for mental health, a culture that is conducive for gender equality, so that we can curb this issue.
Local non-profit The Feminist Alliance Botswana argues the government has not done enough to stop the trend. The organization's Thembiso Nhlekisana says women remain vulnerable.
These figures represent a grim reminder of the pervasive violence that women and girls in our society continue to face. This is not just a statistic. It is a reflection of lives lost, futures stolen, and communities broken. These numbers underscore a profound failure in protecting women and girls from violence, despite repeated calls for systemic reforms and stronger preventative measures.
Nhlekisana calls for swift prosecution and stiffer penalties for perpetrators of gender-based violence.
We call on the Ministry of Justice and Correctional Services and the Botswana Police Service to prioritize cases of gender-based violence, ensuring timely investigations, prosecutions, and convictions for perpetrators.
The African Union Convention on Ending Violence Against Women and Girls says despite efforts to end the vice across Africa, gender-based violence remains all too prevalent. A 2023 report by the World Bank says more than 42% of women in East and Southern Africa experience physical and sexual violence in their lifetime. Qondisi Dube, VOA News, Gaborone, Botswana.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. Coming up on South Sudan in Focus, as Donald Trump gets ready for his inauguration in just a few days, African analysts look at what his administration will mean for the continent.
What do you think? People will speak out on important questions. The question today:
what skill would you most like to master?
I would love to learn how to use my hands, that is craft work, making the baskets and doing more of the clay artwork.
So I think I will go technology any day, anytime. So mastering what I do already, which is practically technology, which is software development, applications development, analysis and data mining.
I would love to play the organ. I love it. I love the sound. I would want to have it at home to play to my family.
Now many people don't like to be teachers. So for me, I'm willing to be.
I appreciate people that I can sing because I can't sing myself and I don't have a very good voice. So I will go for singing.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. As U.S. President-elect Donald Trump prepares to be sworn into office, African analysts weigh in on what governing for the second term president may feel like for the continent compared to his first term. VOA Nairobi Bureau Chief Mariama Diallo has more.
Many people remember U.S. President-elect Donald Trump's first term in office, during which he referred to Africa using degrading language. Edgar Githua is a professor of international relations at Strathmore University in Kenya.
What he called Africa a shithole, excuse my French.
Estimated at over 1 billion people, Africa's population is growing fast and expected to reach 2.5 billion by 2050, according to various estimates. It's a big market that plays a key role in the global economy, Githua says. And in terms of business and trade, Trump may be interested in Africa, but only because of the inroads China has made here.
Since China is hell-bent on capturing Africa as a business destination, so Trump will come to Africa not so much because he really cares about Africa, but because he's coming to counter Chinese influence on the African soil. So that fight, that proxy war, that geopolitical repositioning, in my view, is what could probably benefit Africa.
But Trump's first term saw the birth of initiatives such as Prosper Africa, aimed at facilitating economic engagement between the U.S. and African nations. Since its launch in 2019, the U.S. has helped close nearly 3,000 deals across 49 countries for a value of more than $120 billion, according to figures shared on the initiative's website. While every American president establishes his own policy, many programs, including Prosper Africa, AGOA, or the African Growth and Opportunity Act, and PEPFAR, or the U.S. President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, continue beyond the end of presidents' terms because they have solid bipartisan support in Congress. No matter who's in power in Washington, countries need to redefine what they want and how they want to work with the new administration, Rwandan economic analyst Teddy Kaberuka tells VOA. And while Trump's America First policy may suggest more focus on America, some emerging economies in Africa still can benefit, he says.
Because if he is focused on boosting the domestic production, obviously the U.S. will import a lot of raw material from all over the world, and most likely in Africa, being in minerals, being in agriculture.
Kaberuka says the Ukraine war has hurt African economies, especially the grain supply disruption it caused, triggering a shortage of about 30 million metric tons of grain in Africa in the first year of the war alone, according to the Atlantic Council, a policy research organization based in Washington. He says Trump didn't engage in wars during his first term and complimented the president-elect for publicly stating he aimed to help end the Ukraine war shortly after he takes office.
As an African, as someone who have that overview on the global economy, on African economy, the war we are facing, their consequences, I could say people like me were excited because, you know, from the experience, you know, the Trump administration, there were less wars.
In the Sahel, a region recently plagued by coups, the U.S. closed two military bases and withdrew from Niger last year at the request of a junta that staged a coup the prior year. Their presence, U.S. officials said, was to help the region's counterterrorism efforts. Analyst Rida Liamuri, who's done field work in the Sahel Lake Chad Basin, is a senior fellow at the Policy Center for the New South, a Moroccan-based policy research firm in Washington.
We are seeing increasingly this narrative and this perception that is changing toward the West and accusing the West of being one of the problems why Africa has not seen significant economic development. The priority for the Trump administration to find ways to keep a positive image toward the U.S. and avoid what is currently happening, for example, to France in Francophone Africa.
Liamouri says he doesn't think the Sahel will be a priority for this new administration, but if that was to be, what happened in Niger should be a lesson.
It's a message to the U.S. Going forward to not take things for granted. And I think Niger have been a reliable partner in the region, but this decision shows that it doesn't mean that it's guaranteed that the partnership is going to be forever.
Trump will take the oath of office Monday. Mariama Diallo, VOA News, Nairobi.
The UN support mission in Libya says its new political initiative, which aims to foster elections, consists of six main elements that work in parallel to address immediate and long-term issues. The mission says the elements include forming an advisory committee, unifying the government, launching a comprehensive dialogue, and making economic reforms. Wolfgang Potzai, former Austrian military attaché in Libya, discussed with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi the prospects for peace.
Acting UNSR Stephanie Kuri took over after Abdoulaye Bathily resigned last year on 16 April. Now, almost 9 months later, she announces a major initiative, maybe just days before the UN Security Council confirms a new UN Special Representative. I would say this is somehow strange, as this determines also somehow the policy of her successor, which is certainly not a good idea. And most important, the content of this initiative undermines the credibility of the 5+5, this was a committee between the HOR and the HCS, the two rival parliaments, election laws, and the common efforts of these two rival parliaments to get to a new unity government, which should prepare the elections based on exactly these election laws. In a nutshell, neither the timing nor the content of the UNSMIL initiative is very wise, and members of the HOR and of the HCS have already protested against it.
UNSMIL said that the advisory committee will include no more than 30 members, as its mission will be limited to dealing with developing a roadmap for the elections within specific and short time frame, and it will consist of competent and experienced figures. Is that a better alternative to the national dialogue that was curtailed by the military campaign that LNA Chief General Khalifa Haftar launched in 2019?
There are entirely different circumstances. Now there are already election laws, somehow contested, but nevertheless, by and large, agreed by both of the rival parliaments. And there is somehow a consent between these parliaments, including small steps forward towards the elections. So they are moving steadily, slowly, but steadily towards the elections. In spring 2019, there were no election laws and no progress towards elections whatsoever. That time, UNSR Ghassan Salameh rightly seeked for a broad consensus on the way ahead based on this national dialogue. And I would say if the members of these national dialogues would have been really representative for the Libyan society, as well as, and that's important, representative for those with a real influence on the ground, this would have been a realistic chance to stabilize the country. But obviously, this was not in the interest of Khalifa Haftar. Unfortunately, Salameh's efforts were torpedoed by the LNA commander's military operation to take Tripoli.
UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has expressed his intent to appoint former UN Special Envoy to the Horn of Africa, Hanna Tete, as his Special Envoy to Libya. With several previous UN envoys to Libya, no one managed to pave the way for a political solution. How do you explain that?
There are three main reasons for this. The main initiatives of the UNSRs were disconnected from realities on the ground. The people they were talking with and the people who were negotiating between each other were not representing the people on the ground and also not those with the power in the hands. The next one is the expectations and the goals of the UN Secretary General, who was pushing more than once the respective UNSRs, were unrealistic high. They wanted to get to a final agreement, to a final solution. And the third one, the Libyan internal efforts to find an agreement, especially the efforts between the of the two rival parliaments, were widely ignored. The UN-sponsored 2015 Libya political agreement was negotiated and approved by people who did not have the power on the ground in Tripoli, and also not in the other parts of the country, to implement, while the existing internationally recognized government that was driven out of Tripoli by an Islamist group, namely Prime Minister Abdullah Al-Thani, was totally ignored. I think this is quite unique in the history of the UN. A second example, in 2020, acting UNSR Stephanie Williams handpicked most of the members of the so-called Libya Political Dialogue Forum, the LPDF. They were without any democratic legitimation, and some of the members were contested from the very beginning. And this group had a selection process for the new prime minister that was influenced by bribing. Nevertheless, the outcome, the appointment of nowadays Prime Minister Dabeiba, was internationally accepted and endorsed. I would say, unsurprisingly, this did not lead to stability in Libya.
That was Wolfgang Patzai. He's former Austrian military attaché in Libya, and he was speaking with my colleague, Mohammed El-Shenawi.
VOA Africa is your trusted source for news, sports, entertainment, and music. Stay engaged with VOA Africa. We love to hear your voice. You can call us 24/7 on WhatsApp and leave a message. Leave comments, requests, or greetings. We may play your message on VOA Africa. Dial the international code +1, then 202-258-3076. VOA Africa is always happy to hear your voice. The number again is the international code +1, then 202-258-3076.
It's legendary beats.
And that wraps it up for us this Thursday. We invite you to check out voaafrica.com for all your favorite programs and news updates. If you somehow miss this broadcast, just head on over to www.voaafrica.com/South Sudan. We now leave you with the song Wizkid by Ujul Legba. We've been listening to Ujul Legba by Wizkid. Hope you liked that. I sure did. I'm your host, Carol Van Dam in Washington. On behalf of our engineer, Nelson Lopez, and our producer, Mukbil Yabaro, thanks for tuning in. We'll talk with you tomorrow on another edition of South Sudan in Focus from The Voice of America.